A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a three-parter wrapped in a personal story. He talks about his videography days, back when he couldn't find gear locally without paying some outrageous markup, and he stumbled onto a travel hack, Amazon's other marketplaces. Not .com, not .co, .uk. We're talking Amazon Japan, Amazon Spain, Amazon Germany. He ordered optical media from Japan, paid in yen, got delightful packaging, and surprisingly fast shipping to Israel for a reasonable fee. Which raises the first question, to what extent do these marketplaces still operate as their own fiefdoms, and which ones should people know about? Second question, Amazon once talked about coming to Israel properly, shelved the idea, and now just ships from .com with unattractive shipping and import fees. Why not use a closer marketplace and fulfillment network? Is there any rhyme or reason to that?
There is absolutely rhyme and reason, and it's one of those things where the answer reveals more about Amazon's internal architecture than most people realize. And I love this question because it hits on something that gets almost no mainstream coverage. Everyone talks about Amazon as this global monolith, one company, one system, one seamless experience. The reality is that Amazon is more like a federation of semi-autonomous nation-states that happen to share a logo.
A federation of nation-states sharing a logo. So the fiefdom model from his support center days, still alive and well.
Still alive, and in some ways even more entrenched. Let me give you the architecture. Amazon operates roughly 20 distinct marketplaces globally. The big ones people know, .com for the US, .co.uk for the UK, .d for Germany, .co.jp for Japan. But then you've got Amazon France, Italy, Spain, Canada, Mexico, Brazil, Australia, India, the Netherlands, Sweden, Poland, Turkey, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Singapore. Each one has its own legal entity, its own fulfillment network, its own seller registration, its own product catalog, its own pricing algorithms, and critically, its own P&L. They report their own numbers internally.
Each marketplace is its own profit center.
And that's the key to understanding everything that follows. When a marketplace makes a decision about where to ship, what inventory to stock, which sellers to recruit, it's optimizing for its own bottom line, not Amazon's global convenience. The German team doesn't wake up thinking about how to serve Israeli customers. They wake up thinking about how to serve German customers and hit their quarterly targets. If serving Israel happens to align with that, great. If it doesn't, nobody in Seattle is going to force them.
When Daniel was ordering from Amazon Japan and getting reasonable shipping rates to Israel, that wasn't some global Amazon strategy. That was the Japanese marketplace having its own logistics partnerships that happened to make Israel viable.
And Japan is actually a fascinating case here. Japan Post has historically had very competitive international rates for small parcels, and the Japanese marketplace integrated deeply with Japan Post's EMS service. So you get these optical discs or camera accessories shipped from Tokyo to Tel Aviv in like 4 or 5 days for maybe 1,500 yen. What was that, like $12 at the time? Meanwhile, ordering the same item from .com would cost you $30 in shipping plus potential import headaches.
The delightful Japanese packaging he mentioned, that's also a marketplace-specific thing. Japanese sellers culturally tend to package things with a level of care that's almost performance art. You're not just getting a product, you're getting an unboxing experience.
Which is a market-specific seller behavior that Amazon Japan doesn't mandate, but also doesn't suppress. Whereas, if you order from Amazon Germany, you might get your item rattling around in a box with a single strip of that brown paper that's already crumpled into uselessness by the time it reaches you.
The brown paper of corporate approachability.
There it is. But here's the thing about the fiefdom model. It creates these weird pockets of availability. Daniel mentioned Japan's unusually vibrant optical media market. That's because Japan still has a strong physical media culture. Blu-ray burners, archival-grade discs, specialized formats like MDISC, you can find stuff on Amazon Japan that simply doesn't exist on .com or .d because the demand profile is completely different. Each marketplace reflects its domestic market's quirks.
If you're a consumer in a country that Amazon doesn't officially serve, or serves poorly, like Israel, the hack is to figure out which marketplace's domestic quirks overlap with what you need.
Which one has favorable shipping dynamics? Let me give you a concrete framework. If you're in Israel and you're looking for electronics or camera gear, Amazon Germany and Amazon UK are often better bets than .com. Not just because they're geographically closer, but because they use DHL and local postal networks that have established corridors into Israel. The shipping time from Germany to Israel can be as little as 4 to 6 business days with standard shipping, whereas from the US you're looking at 2 to 3 weeks minimum unless you pay for expedited.
The import fee situation.
This is where it gets complicated, and it ties directly into the second part of the prompt, why Amazon ships to Israel from .com rather than a closer marketplace. So here's the structural problem. Israel's import regime treats different categories of goods differently. Anything under $75 in declared value, and this threshold has been a moving target over the years, is generally exempt from VAT and customs duties. Above that, you're paying 17% VAT plus potential customs depending on the category. Electronics often have zero customs duty under Israel's trade agreements, but you still pay VAT plus a handling fee.
The $75 threshold is the magic number.
It's the magic number, but it's a per-shipment threshold, not a per-item threshold. And this is where Amazon.com's shipping model creates a perverse incentive. When you order from .com to Israel, Amazon consolidates your items into as few shipments as possible to minimize their shipping cost. But that consolidation can push your total declared value above the $75 threshold, triggering VAT and fees that make the whole order unattractive.
The system punishes you for buying more.
Whereas if Amazon were fulfilling from a European marketplace, say Germany, where shipping costs per item are lower, they could potentially split shipments more economically and keep individual packages under the threshold. But that would require the German marketplace to care about optimizing for Israeli customs thresholds, which it doesn't, because Israeli customers aren't its target market.
The fiefdom model creates a structural indifference to cross-border optimization.
That's the first layer of the answer. The second layer is even more fundamental. Amazon.com is the only marketplace that has built any meaningful direct shipping infrastructure to Israel because it's the only one with the scale to justify it. When Amazon looks at a market like Israel, population 9.5 million, GDP per capita high, but total market small, the question isn't, can we serve it? It's, is it worth building dedicated infrastructure for it?
9.5 million people. That's smaller than the population of London.
Smaller than London, smaller than the Los Angeles metro area. For context, Amazon's fulfillment center in San Bernardino alone serves a population catchment of probably 18 million people within a 2-hour drive. Israel's entire population is half that, and it's at the end of a supply chain that requires either air freight or sea freight with customs clearance. The unit economics are brutal.
The shelving of the Israel launch. What actually happened there?
There was a flurry of reporting around 2017 to 2019 about Amazon scouting warehouse space in Israel, talking to local logistics providers, even allegedly negotiating with Israel Post. The plan, as reported at the time, was to launch a localized Hebrew language marketplace with a fulfillment center somewhere in the center of the country, probably around Modi'in, or the Shvela region, where land is available and highway access is good.
That would have been the full Amazon experience. Prime shipping, local inventory, Hebrew interface.
And then it just didn't happen. The official line was always vague. We're always evaluating new markets. Nothing to announce at this time. But the real reasons, based on what logistics analysts have pieced together, come down to three things. 1. The regulatory environment. Israel's import regulations, kosher certification requirements for food products, Standards Institute compliance for electronics. It's a thicket that would require significant legal and operational investment.
The Standards Institution of Israel has entered the chat.
It's not just a bureaucracy problem. It's a genuine complexity problem. Israel has its own electrical plug standard, its own safety certification requirements, its own labeling laws. For a company like Amazon that thrives on standardization, a market that requires custom everything is inherently less attractive.
Plug type H, the three-pronged oddball of the Middle East.
Which is actually a great microcosm of the whole problem. You can't just ship a German market appliance to Israel because the plug is different and the voltage labeling is different even though the voltage itself is compatible. So now you need either a separate SKU for Israel, or you need to include adapters, both of which add cost and complexity.
You said three reasons. What's the second?
Competition and market structure. Israel's e-commerce market is dominated by a few local players, Shufersal's online platform, KSP for electronics, and a handful of others. But more importantly, Israeli consumers had already figured out how to buy from international sites. They were using Amazon.com, they were using AliExpress, they were using ASOS and Next and all the UK fashion retailers. By the time Amazon was evaluating a local launch, the addressable market of Israelis who want to buy from Amazon but can't figure out how was shrinking, not growing.
The early adopters had already self-served.
The third reason, and this one doesn't get talked about enough, is that Amazon's international expansion strategy fundamentally shifted around 2020. Before then, Amazon was willing to enter markets with full infrastructure, fulfillment centers, local websites, Prime, the whole package. Think India in 2013, Australia in 2017. After 2020, the focus shifted to what I'd call capital-light market access. Instead of building warehouses, just improve cross-border shipping from existing fulfillment networks. Instead of launching a local website, just make the existing English language site more accessible.
What changed in 2020?
A few things. One, the pandemic made Amazon's domestic operations so overwhelmed that international expansion became a distraction. Two, the India expansion, which was their big international bet, turned out to be vastly more complex and less profitable than expected. And three, the rise of what Amazon calls Global Store, which is essentially a unified cross-border shopping experience where customers in one country can browse and buy from Amazon's US catalog with localized pricing, import fee estimation, and international shipping.
Instead of building Amazon Israel, they built a slightly better cross-border pipe from .com.
From a corporate strategy perspective, it makes perfect sense. Why spend hundreds of millions building a fulfillment center in Israel when you can just make the .com checkout experience slightly less terrible for Israeli customers and capture 80% of the revenue at 5% of the cost?
Because the remaining 20% is where the actual good experience lives.
And that's the gap Daniel was living in. The official Amazon 2 Israel experience, go to .com, filter by ships to Israel, pay the estimated import fees up front, wait 2 to 3 weeks, is functional but expensive and slow. The unofficial experience. Register on Amazon Japan or Amazon Germany, navigate a foreign language interface, discover that some sellers ship to Israel and some don't, pay in yen or euros, track your package through a foreign postal system, is janky but often cheaper and faster.
It's the difference between the paved road and the desire path.
Amazon, as a company, doesn't really care which one you use as long as the money ends up in their ecosystem. That's the key insight. Amazon's marketplace fees are roughly similar across regions, usually around 15% for most categories. Whether you buy from .com or .d or .co.jp, Amazon gets its cut. The shipping and import friction is your problem, not theirs.
Let me pull on the second question a bit harder. Why specifically .com for the official Israel shipping program and not, say, Amazon Germany? Germany is closer, has lower shipping costs to the Middle East, and uses the same voltage.
It comes down to catalog breadth and seller density. Amazon.com has the largest product catalog of any marketplace, over 350 million products across all categories. Amazon Germany has maybe a third of that. If you're going to build a cross-border shipping program, you want to offer the widest possible selection to maximize the chance that a customer finds what they want. Starting with the marketplace that has the most stuff is the obvious play. Even if the shipping economics are worse. Because the conversion rate, the percentage of visitors who actually find something they want and buy it, matters more to Amazon's internal metrics than the shipping cost, which the customer pays anyway. Amazon doesn't eat the international shipping cost, the customer does. So from Amazon's perspective, the marketplace with the highest conversion potential is the one to build the pipe from.
The Israeli customer's shipping pain is essentially invisible to Amazon's decision-making.
Not entirely invisible. They do care about customer experience in the abstract, but it's not priced into the marketplace selection logic. Now, there's an interesting counterpoint here. For certain categories, Amazon does route inventory through European fulfillment centers for Middle East delivery, but it's done through a program called the European Fulfillment Network, which is designed for the European market. If you're a seller on Amazon Europe and you enroll in EFN, your inventory in a German fulfillment center can be used to fulfill orders from Amazon France, Italy, or Spain. But Israel isn't part of that network because Israel isn't an Amazon marketplace country.
The infrastructure exists to ship from Germany to Israel efficiently. DHL does it every day, but Amazon's internal systems aren't wired to use it for Israeli orders.
Because the German marketplace's fulfillment network is programmed to think of international as other European marketplaces, not a non-marketplace country in the Middle East. The software doesn't have a ship to Israel flag in the German fulfillment center. It has a ship to Israel flag in the US fulfillment centers because that's where the cross-border team built it.
This is the most Amazon sentence I've ever heard. The software doesn't have a ship to Israel flag in the German fulfillment center.
Welcome to how giant tech companies actually work. It's not strategy meetings and white papers. It's feature flags and database fields that someone in a Seattle office either added or didn't add 3 years ago, and now the entire customer experience for 9.5 million people is shaped by that decision.
Let's shift to the practical part of the prompt. What are the major marketplaces people should know about, and what are their quirks?
Let me run through the ones that matter for cross-border shopping, especially from a market like Israel. Number 1. Amazon Germany. Amazon.de is the second largest marketplace by revenue after .com. Massive selection in electronics, tools, home goods. Ships reliably to Israel via DHL. The interface is in German, but Chrome's translation handles it fine. Prices are often lower than .com for European brand goods. Think Bosch, Miele, Kircher, because those brands price for the European market and don't inflate for US import costs.
The voltage compatibility.
Anything electronic from Germany works in Israel out of the box except the plug, and a plug adapter is 2 shekels, whereas something from .com might be 110 volts and require a transformer. .co.uk, post-Brexit. It's become slightly more complicated for European shipping because the UK is outside the EU customs union, but for Israel it was always outside anyway, so the impact is minimal. The UK marketplace is excellent for books, obviously, but also for specialty food items, fashion, and anything where British brands dominate. Shipping to Israel is generally reliable, though it can be slower than Germany.
The pound sterling pricing can work in your favor depending on exchange rates.
Number 3 is the dark horse, Amazon Japan. .co.jp. This is the one Daniel discovered for optical media, and it's genuinely underrated. Japan has a unique retail culture that carries products you simply won't find on Western marketplaces. High-end stationery, specialty kitchen equipment, camera accessories, audio gear, certain categories of electronics where Japanese domestic models are superior to export versions.
The Japanese domestic market versions of things are often the best versions.
It's a known phenomenon. Japanese consumers are famously demanding about quality, so manufacturers often produce a domestic market version with better components or additional features that never leaves Japan. Amazon Japan is the easiest way to access that. The catch, and it's a significant catch, is that Amazon Japan requires a separate account registration, and the interface is entirely in Japanese, not mostly Japanese with some English.
Which is its own filter. If you're willing to navigate that, you're probably the kind of buyer who knows exactly what you want.
Number 4. Amazon Spain and Amazon Italy. These are smaller marketplaces, but they occasionally have pricing anomalies. Because they're part of the EU single market, inventory flows freely between them and the larger German and French marketplaces, but local pricing algorithms sometimes create weird deals. If you're buying something from a European brand, it's worth checking .es and .it just to see if the algorithm has priced it lower there.
The pricing algorithm arbitrage play.
It's surprisingly effective for certain categories. Shoes from Amazon Italy, for example, Italian warehouse, Italian pricing, ships to Israel through the same DHL network that everything else uses. Number 5. Amazon UAE. Amazon.ae, which is actually the old souk.com that Amazon acquired in 2017 and rebranded. This one is interesting for Israel specifically because it's geographically close, and there's been a normalization of trade relations. Shipping from the UAE to Israel is fast, sometimes 2 to 3 days, and the product selection is curated for the Middle East market, which means you'll find things that are relevant to the region.
Is there an Israel-specific shipping program from UAE?
Not officially, but individual sellers on Amazon UAE do ship to Israel, and because the logistics corridor is short, it's often faster than anything from Europe or the US. The limitation is catalog size. Amazon UAE has maybe 30 million products compared to .com's 350 million. Number 6, and this one is worth mentioning even though it's not Amazon, AliExpress. It's not an Amazon marketplace, but it's become the default alternative for Israeli consumers who find Amazon's shipping costs prohibitive. AliExpress ships almost everything to Israel, often with free or extremely low-cost shipping, and they've optimized their logistics for the Israeli market to an extent Amazon hasn't.
AliExpress essentially ate the low-end cross-border market that Amazon didn't bother competing for.
They did it by solving the exact problem Amazon won't solve, making small package, low-value shipping to Israel economically viable. AliExpress has integrated with Israel Post and local courier services to the point where a $3 item from Shenzhen arrives in your mailbox in 2 weeks with tracking. Amazon has no equivalent for that because their model is built around consolidated, higher-value shipments.
Which circles back to the threshold problem. AliExpress items are almost always under $75 individually, so they slide under the import radar.
Whereas Amazon's consolidation model pushes you over. It's a structural disadvantage that Amazon seems entirely uninterested in fixing for a market of 9.5 million people.
Let me ask you something about the fiefdom structure. Is it actually getting more entrenched, or is there a counter-trend towards centralization?
There's tension in both directions. On one hand, Amazon has been building more centralized infrastructure. AWS is centralized, that's the profit engine that funds everything else. The advertising platform is increasingly centralized. The Prime Video content licensing is negotiated globally rather than market by market. But the retail operations, the actual buying, selling, storing, and shipping of physical goods, remain stubbornly decentralized. And I think that's because retail is inherently local in ways that software isn't.
A warehouse is a physical thing in a specific place with specific labor laws and specific transportation links.
You can't abstract away the fact that a fulfillment center in Rheinberg, Germany, is subject to German labor law, German energy costs, German transportation regulations. That fulfillment center's manager reports up through the German marketplace organization, and their performance is measured on metrics that optimize for German and European customers. The idea of that manager making decisions to benefit Israeli customers is organizationally incoherent.
Even if Amazon wanted to route Israeli orders through Germany, the incentive structure fights against it.
Amazon's corporate culture, famously, does not reward fighting against incentive structures. It rewards optimizing within them. If you're a product manager at Amazon Germany and you propose spending engineering resources to build a ship to Israel workflow, the first question you'll get is, how does this improve our German marketplace metrics? And the honest answer is, it doesn't really. So the project dies.
The invisible hand of the quarterly review.
Now, there is one development worth watching. Amazon has been expanding what they call global store features, and there are signs they're experimenting with multi-origin fulfillment, meaning an order placed on .com might be fulfilled from a European warehouse if it's closer to the customer. This is already happening within Europe, and there have been job postings suggesting they're building the infrastructure to do it more broadly.
The software flag might eventually get added.
But eventually, at Amazon scale, means years, not months. And it'll happen first for larger markets, Canada to Mexico, US to South America, before anyone thinks about Israel.
Let me pull on a thread Daniel mentioned in passing. He said he worked at an Amazon support center before moving to Israel and got a look at how the business units operated internally. The fiefdom structure isn't just a logistics thing, it's cultural.
It's deeply cultural. Amazon is organized around what they used to call two pizza teams. Teams small enough to be fed with two pizzas. The idea was to keep teams autonomous and fast-moving. But when you apply that philosophy to international marketplaces, you get what are essentially independent companies that share a brand, a tech stack, and a CEO. Each marketplace has its own country manager who operates with significant autonomy. They make decisions about pricing, promotions, seller recruitment, and even which products to feature. The .com team doesn't tell the Japan team what to do. They're not supposed to.
This works until it doesn't.
It works until a customer in a country that doesn't fit neatly into any marketplace's territory tries to do something cross-border, and suddenly the seams show. The system wasn't designed for Daniel in Jerusalem ordering optical discs from Tokyo. It was designed for Daniel in Tokyo ordering optical discs from Tokyo. The fact that it works at all is kind of remarkable.
It's a happy accident of standardized web infrastructure and global postal networks.
A lot of the cross-border functionality that exists on Amazon marketplaces wasn't built by Amazon. It was demanded by sellers. A Japanese electronics retailer wants to sell to international customers because the margins are better. So they pressure Amazon Japan to enable international shipping options. Amazon Japan adds the feature because it keeps sellers happy, not because it has a strategic vision for serving Israeli videographers.
The sellers are the ones pushing the boulder uphill.
Amazon lets them, because seller fees are revenue, regardless of where the buyer lives. So you get this patchwork of shipping options that varies by marketplace, by seller, by product category, sometimes even by individual listing. One seller on Amazon Germany ships to Israel. Another seller on the same marketplace selling the same product doesn't. There's no global policy. It's entirely down to seller preference and marketplace level settings.
Which makes the whole thing feel like a treasure hunt.
That's exactly what it is. The people who get good at cross-border Amazon shopping develop an intuition for which marketplaces carry which categories, which sellers tend to ship internationally, and how to navigate the customs implications. It's a skill. Daniel clearly developed it, but it shouldn't have to be a skill. The fact that it is tells you everything about how Amazon is actually structured versus how it appears from the outside.
To wrap the first question, the fiefdom model is alive and well. The major marketplaces worth knowing are Germany, UK, Japan, Spain, Italy, and UAE. And the whole thing works despite Amazon rather than because of it.
That's a fair summary. And on the second question, why .com for Israel and not a closer marketplace? The answer is a mix of catalog breadth, incentive misalignment, software limitations, and simple market size math. 9.5 million people isn't enough to justify rebuilding the fulfillment logic.
You know what strikes me about all of this? It's the same pattern we see in so many other domains. A giant company builds a system optimized for its own internal logic, and the people at the edges, the ones who don't fit neatly into a marketplace territory, are left to cobble together their own solutions. And some of those solutions are clever. The travel hack of registering on Amazon Japan to buy optical media is clever.
It's clever, and it's also a window into how global commerce actually works versus how the marketing brochures say it works. The brochures say one seamless global marketplace. The reality is 20 fiefdoms, a patchwork of shipping rules, and a small army of determined customers figuring out the gaps.
Like adopting a feral cat.
I was going to say like navigating a medieval trade route, but yours is better.
You show up in a foreign marketplace, you don't speak the language, you hand over your yen, and somehow a package arrives at your door 3 weeks later wrapped in beautiful Japanese paper. There's something almost romantic about it.
The romance of logistics. That's a Herman Poppleberry sentence if I've ever heard one.
It really is.
Here's the thing, and this connects to the broader picture of Israel's cost of living that we've discussed before. The fact that cross-border Amazon shopping is even a thing that Israeli consumers invest time in learning is a symptom of a deeper problem. When local retail is dominated by oligopolies that mark up imported goods by 50 or 100%, consumers are going to find workarounds. The workarounds are inefficient. They require knowledge and effort and risk. But they exist because the alternative is worse.
The 500% markup problem.
Amazon, for all its flaws, provides a price discovery mechanism. When you can see that the exact same camera lens costs $400 on Amazon Germany, including shipping and import fees, and $650 at the local electronics chain, the local price starts to look less like a market price and more like a tax on convenience.
Or a tax on not knowing about the workaround.
That's the part that bothers me. The people who benefit most from cross-border shopping are the people with the time, language skills, and technical confidence to navigate it. Everyone else pays the local markup. It's a regressive system.
The travel hack is also a privilege hack.
And I don't think Amazon cares about that either. But it's worth naming. There's one more thing I want to add about the marketplace structure before we move on. There's an emerging trend that might change some of this, and it's the rise of what Amazon calls strategic account services for large sellers. Essentially, Amazon is building tools that let big sellers list once and fulfill everywhere, a kind of seller-side globalization that bypasses the marketplace fiefdoms. If you're a major brand, you can now work with Amazon to get your products listed across multiple marketplaces simultaneously, with inventory routed through Amazon's global logistics network.
The big sellers get the unified experience, while the small sellers and the customers are still in fiefdom land.
The rich get globalization, the poor get treasure hunts. It's the Amazon way.
That's the show. That's the whole show right there. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In 1784, a French trader in Madagascar documented the local sport of sepak takraw, noting that the ball used was made of rattan and measured approximately 3/4 of a French pied du roi in circumference, roughly 24 modern centimeters, equivalent to 0.00015 miles.
Equivalent to 0.00015 miles.
Because when I think of a rattan ball in Madagascar, the first thing I need is the mileage. That was very specifically unhelpful.
This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps people find the show. Find us at myweirdprompts.com.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.